The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
26-year-old Henry Tay decided to become a midwife when his sister died in childbirth.
She was in pain at the time.
She was in pain at the time. She was trying to walk from the nearby town to another town where we have the clinic. She started bleeding severely, and there was no car available.
Now, Henry's one of 8 male midwives in all of Liberia, but women don't like it.
For me, if a strange man who is not my boyfriend, if he sees my private parts, I can be too ashamed.
And cutting wood in Nepal.
Every once in a while, as a tree is getting ready to tip over, someone yells, Frankly, there's not really anywhere to go. So mostly, that's just the signal to look up, add to the shouting, and be glad you're not in the wrong place.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In Afghanistan, violence against women and girls is widespread, and it takes all forms: domestic abuse, forced marriage, even honor killings. Now, an organization called Women for Afghan Women has set up a family guidance center in Kabul. Abused women can go there for shelter and legal advice. But as reporter Will Everett found out, the shelter has also become a haven for lovelorn teenage girls.
3 teenage girls in headscarves sit around a table sipping tea and chatting about a subject that teenage girls talk about everywhere: their boyfriends. 2 of them are sisters, 15 and 16 years old, who want to marry guys their parents don't approve of. At first glance, you'd never think these lighthearted girls were runaways. Their giggles and smiles contrast with the serious demeanor of the third girl, 17-year-old Shabnan. She too has met a guy that her parents don't approve of, but her situation is even more complicated.
I came here because I just didn't know what to do next. I was hearing so many things from so many people, and I really needed advice.
When she was 12, her father engaged her to a distant cousin, a man in his 40s. She says everyone knew he was lazy and promiscuous. Shabnam's own aunt had once been engaged to the man, but then fled to Iran to avoid marrying him.
I don't know why my father engaged me to such a man. I told him I didn't want it, but they had the ceremony anyway. This man has no money and is lazy. He wouldn't be able to provide for a family.
In Afghanistan, an engagement is considered a binding contract. Shabnam felt the only way out was to kill herself. She even decided how she'd do it, by setting herself on fire. And then she met Abdullah, a 24-year-old shopkeeper.
I liked Abdullah right away. We began talking on the phone secretly. He asked me to marry him, but I couldn't break my engagement. My father never would have allowed it. Abdullah heard about his guidance center and we decided to try it. So he closed up his shop and we ran away together.
For 2 days, she's been hiding out here, a family guidance center run by Women for Afghan Women. It provides counseling, legal support, and mediation for women who are victims of what we'd call domestic abuse. But Executive Director Manisha Naderi shies away from that term.
We don't like to call it domestic violence because in the West and in most people's minds, when you say domestic violence, it just implies that she's being beaten up or hit or slapped by her husband, which isn't the case in Afghanistan. It's more severe in Afghanistan.
She says that cases like Shabnam's are sometimes the most dangerous because a family's pride and honor are at stake. Many women who refuse arranged marriages become the victims of honor killings at the hands of their fathers or brothers. That's why the Family Guidance Center also runs a shelter at an undisclosed location. Lena Sultani is the counselor assigned to Shabnam's case. She's contacted the girl's family to try to get them to sit down and discuss Shabnam's future.
This case is difficult because the girl already has a fiancé. Before we can focus on her relationship with her boyfriend, we have to break the former engagement. So we have to get her family in here to talk about it, and that can be tough to do.
Sultani says the family is furious, and so far they've refused to come. But if a family does sit down and talk with her, she says they can usually be reasoned with. Shabnam, the girl in the middle of all this, hopes her forced engagement can be broken soon so that she can start making plans to get married. She says Abdullah's family likes her and has agreed to the match.
We thought about running away to Iran, but his family said, don't do it. You'll always have a cloud of shame hanging over your marriage. Also, we didn't want our families to be enemies.
While she's talked to Abdullah many times on the phone, they've only met in person a handful of times. When I ask her if she's ever kissed him, she blushes and admits that she hasn't.
But I like him a lot. He's a good person and a devoted businessman. He works day and night at his shop. I know he would be a good provider.
What will she do if her parents refuse the match? She says she'll go along with what they say. But, she adds, she'd sooner die than marry the other guy. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Kabul, Afghanistan.
Liberia, there's been a dramatic break with tradition for women, and it has to do with midwives. In this West African country, women have a 1 in 12 chance of dying in childbirth. A report by UNICEF says most of the deaths could be prevented if more women had access to trained midwives. But there's a serious shortage of them in the country. So a midwifery school in a remote corner of the country is trying something new. It's training men to deliver babies. Bonnie Allen reports.
Henry Tay places his hands on the large belly of a pregnant woman.
Okay, Ruthly, what is happening to you this morning?
He presses his fingers down, pushing and poking to feel the position of the fetus. Then he asks for the woman's permission.
Okay, ladies. Excuse me.
A midwife in training, the 26-year-old Liberian man knows he has to be careful as he stretches a green measuring tape over the woman's bare stomach.
In our setting, we have tradition that people really, there are some
in
women.
In our setting, traditionally, there are some women who are not really comfortable with men checking them. And when it comes to physical examination on women, they don't really accept that because of the private parts.
Until recently, male midwives were unheard of in Liberia. But last year, the midwifery training program in the remote town of Zwedru accepted 24 women and 8 men. Henry Tay jumped at the opportunity. His 19-year-old sister recently died giving birth. She lived in a remote village with no medical care.
She was in pain at the time.
She was in pain at the time. She was trying to walk from the nearby town to another town where we have the clinic. She started bleeding severely, and there was no car available.
Nearby villagers loaded her into a hammock and carried her several miles to the next town. An ambulance eventually arrived, but the nearest hospital was still a 3-hour drive away.
She gave up.
She gave up. She died on the highway. That really prompted me to go into this profession.
Liberia desperately needs trained midwives. It has close to 4 million people, and at last count, just 400 midwives. But whether Henry Tay will be accepted as a midwife is another matter. Today, he's doing his clinical training at the hospital in Zwedru. In the crowded waiting room, a young pregnant woman expresses reluctance.
For me, if different man is not my boyfriend, that's going on with me. You see my private
For me, she says, if a strange man who is not my boyfriend, if he sees my private parts, I can be too ashamed. Even seeing my breasts, it's very shameful to me. That's why they have ladies here, to do that. So, why train men?
They got male doctors. They got male nurses.
They have male doctors. They have male nurses. And so, midwifery should not be limited to only women.
That's Sawa Shafa, an instructor at the midwifery school Henry Tay attends. An international medical aid agency called Merlin runs it. The school just reopened after being closed for almost 20 years due to war. The challenge now? Few women in rural Liberia have graduated from high school, a requirement for this program. So, one more reason to recruit men.
Good morning, ma'am.
Oh.
On this day, Samuel Yangpo is on the female ward doing hands-on training. He carefully slides on his rubber gloves and unwraps a plastic bag of clear fluid. He fumbles a bit, then awkwardly attaches an IV line to a woman's arm. As a boy, Yangpo dreamed of becoming a doctor, but the war interrupted his education. He only finished high school 2 years ago at the age of 28, and with no money for university, this program, with free tuition, food, and housing, seemed like his best option.
People discourage me that this fee is only for women. I felt to myself that my people suffering a lot, and as a man, I'll be able to help women.
But some women reject that help.
For our Liberian culture, women believe that only a woman can deliver a woman.
In our Liberian culture, women believe that only a woman can deliver a woman, especially in the rural areas. So they're having a problem, and so we have to reduce the number of male midwives.
The newest batch of midwifery students push their wooden desks into a circle as they begin a class. There are 34 women and just 2 men here. Training manager Rex Moses admits the number of men who qualified was much higher than 2. In fact, based on the entrance exam, there should be more men enrolled than women. But the backlash from some community leaders and women forced him to restrict the number of male students this year.
And we have to listen to the voices of the people because they are the prime users of the services that we are going to give. We want for women not to shy from the delivery rooms or from the antenatal clinics. So if you have a project that is designed for a group of people and there is reason concern, you have to listen to them.
Back in Henry Tay's exam room, he says he is not discouraged.
So you only come for checkout this morning, right?
Like his classmates, he has signed a contract with the Ministry of Health. It guarantees him a full-time job, and in return, he will serve 3 years in rural Liberia, wherever the need is greatest.
And anytime you get sick, you come for treatment.
The young man is confident that wherever he works, he will gain the trust of pregnant mothers and get the medical help before it's too late. For the World Vision Report, I'm Bonnie Allen in Zwaju, southeastern Liberia.
There's a slideshow with this story. It's on our website at worldvisionreport.org. Some farmers grow corn for food. Some grow it for fuel. Hear more about the corn debate after a short break. Stay with us on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Until recently, the world looked at corn simply as a food staple. It's in our cereal, our baked goods, and our tortillas. But more and more, farmers are growing corn for the production of ethanol. Ethanol is a biofuel which can be used in cars in place of fossil fuel. Since fossil fuels are culprits in global warming, it would seem obvious that biofuels are good for the globe. Not so, says ActionAid. The Anti-Poverty Agency issued a report saying that diverting corn to biofuel is disastrous for the developing world because the poor need that corn for food. Business Week writer Robin Farzad is here to explain. He says the food versus fuel debate intensified a couple of years ago when the cost of oil skyrocketed and more people looked to corn for a solution.
When you had oil go to $140, suddenly it makes it super lucrative, and all these farmers are getting overtures left and right to divert their crops to ethanol startups that are paying ever more for that crop.
So this report from ActionAid has a quite alarming statistic, which is that 100 million people could go without food if this continues in the European Union and the United States, do you think it's really this bad?
I think that it illustrates, again, the zero-sum relationship that you really can't have the best of both worlds, cheap gasoline and cheap, plentiful food going forward. Because what this speaks to is there are two crises in parallel that are actually intersecting. The world is facing increasingly a shortage of arable land and crops as populations come online, as China and India and Brazil, more people come out of poverty and demand not just food, but meat, which is much more corn intensive, and you have to put aside more land for animals to graze on. And at the same time, these people are demanding cars, and they're using gasoline. As these economies are growing at very white hot speed, oftentimes, especially vis-a-vis the developed world, they are taking ever more of the share of petroleum, which seems to have kind of petered out. We're not seeing that much growth and capacity being brought online, and hence we used to get worried when oil broke $30 a barrel. Well, it seems like $70 is the new $30 in this world order. And we certainly saw it double at that price when all of this happened at once in 2008.
What's happening with corn now here in the United States? Is there still any push at all to use corn for ethanol?
It's suddenly become very taboo in venture communities and in sustainable development communities and in clean tech and green tech that, as you can see, you know, biofuel itself, the idea of a biofuel has been sullied. It used to sound very green, very relaxing. You'd see it on a, you know, Cargill commercial, on a, something you'd see Sunday morning while watching Meet the Press. Biofuel is suddenly a bad word because of the experience we have with food-based biofuels.
Because they realize during this time that poor people were really suffering as a result of this.
That's true. But I think the flip side of this is suddenly the opportunity and the profit upside is bigger than ever for somebody who can come up with that holy grail of an abundant, prolific, cheap, non-food-based biofuel source. Now, if you could do it at parity, you know, say at $2 or $2.50 a gallon and promise that, you know, I can provide lots of it, it can come online, feast or famine or whatever the price of oil, let's say above $50 or $60, then you're going to get lots of community, lots of money from the venture capital community there. So if somebody is out there, you know, that finds a magical, mystical crop that is very hardy and just grows the instant you pull it out and grows on land that otherwise wouldn't be used for corn or for grazing and can turn around and very cheaply and prolifically produce it, well, you're in the money.
And is anybody discovering such a crop?
1,000 of these roses are in the process of blooming right now. Everybody claims to have them. I visited a couple of startups, you know, on both ends of controversy. There was one in Mozambique that I was visiting. I visited in 2007 that specializes in the it crop there, which is Jatropha. It's a hardy, oily seed that grows on wasteland, land that's been fallow for years and has grown over and it's malarial. And really, there's nobody there that arguably would want this land for ostensibly a food use. It's prohibitively difficult to convert it into something that would help feed people. So why not use that? It's very resistant to weather cycles. It can deal with salinity in the soil. And that has become the biodiesel it crop of Eastern Africa, at the very least. And you're seeing it not just in Mozambique, but moving up all the way near Kenya and Somalia.
What's the downside there?
Well, the downside is that it kind of smacks of neocolonialism. It's still extractive. It's still, by and large, Dutch and British white investors coming in and saying, well, we'd like to open these plantations. And gosh, when you hear the term plantation, I mean, it's so, you know, it's so antebellum. It's so civil war. Again, the argument that they make, the retort is that if we weren't here, this land wouldn't be touched. On the absolute flip side of that, I visited a startup outside of Chicago called Coscada, which specializes in converting waste, dry garbage, into biofuels. It tricks certain bacteria into consuming, gosh, I don't want to sound too jargony. Well, if you superheat and gasify plastic, these bacteria love to feast on that plastic and emit biofuel effectively. And they say they can do this at an equivalent of $1.50 a gallon. And certainly we throw billions and billions of tons of plastic away. So it doesn't really eat into anybody's food crop. It isn't land intensive, but it's still speculative. It's still unproven. Can it be done sustainably? Are the logistics right? Can we divert enough trash and wood chips and other things into these laboratories just to even cut a dent into the massive overdependence that we have on fossil fuel-based gasoline? And that's an open question.
Robin Farzad is a senior writer with Business Week. Robin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Peggy. I appreciate it.
Being green is fashionable these days. There's organic food, organic clothing, even organic soap. But an organic farm in Indonesia is doing more than saving the environment. It's saving street kids at the same time. Salen Onorin reports from West Java, Indonesia.
40 young men stand in front of a large greenhouse and welcome visitors with a homemade hymn. Let's go, and strive to progress. Let's get rid of poverty and ignorance, they sing. Each guy wears a pair of green rubber boots, but that's about the only thing on them that's typical farm wear. Ethnic tattoos peep from underneath hard rub t-shirts, low-hanging jeans reveal urban-style underwear, and the sun sometimes reflects the shimmer of a pierced tongue. All of these young men come from tough backgrounds, many are farmer street kids. And they're all here for 5 months to learn how to farm organically, including 19-year-old Eggy.
The first time I came here to be a farmer man, I didn't dare get my hands dirty.
Eggy kneels in the soil in front of a line of deep green stalks of broccoli and prepares to water them. He wipes his forehead with his arm, displaying intricate skin art that, he says with a laugh, he tattooed on himself. Fake silver chain around his neck, little ring in one ear, gelled hair that sticks up. Eggy says he's discovered that even in the countryside, you can be cool.
I tried and yeah, I saw that this is a cool job. And if you're tired, then you can take a break and joke around with your friends.
The farm belongs to an organization called the Learning Farm. It trains troubled youth, aged 15 to 22, in organic farming. But its goal goes beyond learning a new trade. Jiwei Tong is the American-born director of the program. He says the kids have to learn how to work together, and that's not easy.
We had machetes, we had hoes, we had pitchforks. So we had to have these tools under lock and key. And then, you know, in the fields, we have to have them under close supervision because with the street kids, they come as rival organizations and bring these feuds here.
The farm implements a strict discipline. For instance, if you wake up late, you have to run up the steep hill that leads from the main road with a sign that says you're lazy. And that works, Jiwei says, even with kids as tough as his.
A lot of these youth, in their lives, there's been very little in the way of expectations or accountability. So the discipline that we insist on is a way of saying that we value your potential. Just as nature holds us all accountable, if we don't apply good farming methods and we don't follow up on a daily basis, the crops tell the story to the youth.
Susanto, a gruff 17-year-old, cautiously fills up his watering can with foul-smelling, greenish water, the farm's fresh fertilizer, straight from the goat's pen. Despite his tough posture, Susanto is shy, keeping his eye on the ground when he speaks. He says 3 years ago, he ran away from an abusive home and since then has lived on the street.
I liked living in the streets. There's no one to tell you what to do. I stole a little, did drugs. Well, all the stuff you do when you live in the streets.
Susanto carefully walks back towards the greenhouse and starts watering young sprouts of coriander. He struggles to keep his watering can from falling apart. It's his first week at the farm, and everything feels awkward. He heard about this program from a graduate who now runs a successful farm. Susanto says, for him, coming here was a question of life and death.
I saw a lot of friends die, either beaten up by the police or because of drug overdose. I was afraid the same would happen to me.
In 5 years, the Learning Farm has trained around 300 young men to become organic farmers. About a third of them find jobs in the field. It's almost noon, and school children from the neighboring village are racing down the path that borders the farm. Eggy, who has come to tend a pepper tree, says he's got big plans after he graduates.
When I'm done here and go back home, I could take a group of friends and we'll all work together like that. And who knows what's going to happen? Maybe in 5 years we could open our own supermarket. Why not? If we want to, we could. No?
His own supermarket, that's quite a dream. But it may be feasible. After all, the Learning Farm itself is in negotiations with a major grocery store chain to supply it with organic produce. Watching the kids playing around like puppies while they walk to lunch, one thing seems clear. Here at last, they've found some hope. For the World Vision Report, I'm Solène Honorine in Cianjur, Indonesia.
Bondan Prokoso and his band Fade to Black are back on the charts this week in Indonesia. The popular hip-hop group uses traditional music called Kroncong combined with rock and rap to appeal to a wide audience. Here's their first single based on an old Indonesian song. It's called Kroncong Protong. Cuma saja, diam berdiri, nanti sampai rumah malah pengen denger lagi. Lagi, ya terus saja, jika begini jadi ngatusia senja. Jika lo kau nanti lo... That's Indonesian singer Bondan Prokoso singing Kroncong Protong. Apalagi jika kau dengar alunan kesang, tapi please dong ayam dengar jangan parno. In the village of Kosciuszko, Nepal, residents still use wood to build fires for heat and cooking. Reporter Laura Spiro often travels to Kosciuszko and stays with a woman she calls Ama, or mother. Ama lights her family's fire each morning for warmth and cooks rice over the fire twice a day. All of that takes a lot of firewood, and that takes a lot of gathering. Laura recently joined Ama and a crowd of neighbors on their wood-gathering expedition in the forest. Then she sent us this reporter's notebook.
I did have to convince Ama that I wouldn't fall or chop off my hand. But she finally relented and let me come along with everyone to cut firewood. So here I am with my sickle, standing with our next-door neighbor, Sarasoti, and six other women on a treacherous slope that's thick with underbrush and thorny things that want to stab my sandaled feet. A few dozen more neighbors are scattered among the trees. The Nepali name for a lush forest like this is the bun. But you can't just go and start hacking down trees in the bun anytime you want to. There's a village committee that schedules community wood chopping trips in an assigned area. The system helps prevent widespread deforestation. The first time I came on one of these excursions to the bun, Sarasoti's father-in-law instructed me to take my sickle and cut down a slender, teenage tree. When he does this, he leaves a smooth stump where you could balance a teacup. I, on the other hand, chiseled out a carpet of receding gouges until my tree clunked wearily to the ground. But today, while the men continue to chop down trees, the other women and I are cutting logs into smaller pieces and carrying them to a nearby clearing, which is great, because I'm a much better wood carrier than wood chopper. Every once in a while, as a tree is getting ready to tip over, someone yells, Frankly, there's not really anywhere to go. So mostly, that's just the signal to look up, add to the shouting, and be glad you're not in the wrong place. It's all very rugged. I'm wrapping a rope around a bundle of branches when Sarasoti starts singing a song that makes her think of her husband, who she married a few years ago. He's away now, working construction in Qatar. I'm kind of surprised when Sarasoti gets teary, because I know he's never treated her very well. We each sling a heavy bundle of wood from our heads and set off in a line up the unstable slope, placing our feet carefully in the underbrush. And then, the woman in front of me picks up her cell phone. Yeah, her cell phone. The conversation goes something like this. Hello? Yeah, I'm carrying wood. Right, okay. I'm carrying wood right now. When we get to the clearing, another woman named Goma realizes she's missed a call. I seem to be the only one of us who didn't bring a cell phone with me to the bun. I'm also probably the only one in our group who can read or work the electronic menus in these phones. Most of the women only know how to receive calls. So Goma asks me to figure out who called her. I find the number.
No, add 0, to, teen, sa, to, 0. And you?
And call back.
Busy.
Busy.
From our clearing, the hollow sound of wood being cut is a distant echo, floating up from the treetops. We've made many trips up here already today, and we're tired. So we linger for a minute and let the late afternoon turn from yellow to gold on the grass. And then a call comes for us. It's getting dark. One of the older boys stands in our clearing and calls everyone out of the thick trees below. We put the phones away and begin the long walk home.
Laura Sparrow is a freelance journalist based in New York. Those phones are a good way to keep in touch, whether you're in Nepal or New York. But there's another reason cell phones come in handy, and that's the subject of this week's Globe at a Glance. In Bangladesh, people are using their cell phones to dial the number 3000. When they get through, they don't chat with a friend or family member. They get a 3-minute English lesson. At 5 cents a lesson, it's the cheapest way to learn the language. Students dial in 5 days a week for 18 months. They get lessons in conversation, pronunciation, and basic English grammar. Speaking English is seen as a passport to a better life for thousands of Bangladeshis, and it's key to getting a job in the export-oriented textile industry and service industries like banking. The English lesson service is called Janala. That means window in Bengali. It's the brainchild of the BBC World Service Trust, the charity arm of the British broadcaster. They're hoping to teach 6 million Bangladeshis to speak English by 2011, and they're well on their way. The program's a huge hit. On the first day, instead of the 25,000 who were expected, more than 80,000 signed on. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Waymire.
Hey, Emmanuel Jao, come in, man. You're the rap artist from Africa.
Good afternoon,
oh, great.
Sir. Good afternoon.
You come just in time. We just pulled out the rap.
You've just been introduced to Emmanuel Jao, the former child soldier turned rapper. There's more about him and his music coming up on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In the United States, you'll often find flowers on the dinner table, but no one thinks of eating them. That's not the case in Mexico, where you're about as likely to find flowers in the food as on the table. Mexicans have been cooking with flowers and eating them for centuries. Mary Stuckey finds out how they taste.
In the food market, in the village of Malinalco, about 2 hours southwest of Mexico City, the tortillas, fruits, vegetables, and flowers are much the same as when the Spanish conquistadors first arrived 500 years ago. The Spanish were amazed by the profusion of flowers in Mexico, not only to decorate tables and altars, but also for food.
And here are the colorines, which are bright scarlet red. They're absolutely beautiful. They look like a poinsettia Christmas plant.
We're with Mexican food expert and writer Nicholas Gilman. He spotted the scarlet red flowers of the tree called colorine. There are piles of these flowers on a cloth at the feet of the elderly woman selling them. They're sometimes called bird tongues and look a bit like little red fingers.
This is something that's been eaten here since pre-colonial times. This was a stronghold of the Aztecs, and they have always eaten colorine.
Just around the corner from the market is the fonda, or homestyle restaurant, of Luz Maria Valesco Garcia. She's at her stove cooking little egg pancakes, or tortitas. Mixed in are pieces of bright red flowers, colorine.
Primero las limpio bien.
First she cleans them well.
Y después las hiervo con sal.
And then she boils them with salt.
Una piedrita chiquita de tequesquite para que queden verdecitos.
And a little piece of some sort of volcanic stone which keeps the color from disappearing.
Then she mixes the colorine with egg and cheese, fries them in a little oil, and serves the tortitas with a red or green salsa.
Mmm. It's hard to tell what the colorine actually tastes like. It's more of a texture. It has a little bite to it. Very slight hint of bitterness, which is nice, mixed with the saltiness and the spiciness of the salsa.
But colorine is only one of the many flours Mexicans cook with, maybe a dozen different kinds. No one knows for sure. Roses and rose petals are everywhere at the enormous Jamaica Flower Market in Mexico City.
This section is only roses.
Sometimes used to make syrup and to flavor ice cream, according to the food writer Ruth Alegria, our guide at this market. The cook at one food stall here stands at a long griddle behind rows of corn tortillas piled high with yellow squash blossoms, flowers from the squash plant, of course.
So she'll turn them over on the flat griddle, and that cooks the cheese with the flour.
Flowers in Mexico are almost always eaten cooked, not raw.
Now this is the one we're all going to have a little taste of, because this is, and I'll have the first taste just to make sure it's okay.
The squash blossoms, called flor de calabaza, have a subtle taste, slightly lemony.
That's delicious.
Many of the flowers in Mexico are cooked in the same way and added into tacos, tamales, and the quesadilla I'm eating as I listen to the musicians who rove the market.
Let's walk this way and then over to the other side. See this little white flower? That's chamomile. And the chamomile is for teas. This orange flower that I thought was a sempasuchil or a marigold is not a marigold.
Para anginas.
He says it's for your tonsils. You make a tea of it and then you gargle it.
Flowers have recently found their way onto the menus of some of the most exclusive restaurants in Mexico City, where chefs sometimes concoct multi-course meals using flowers in new and interesting ways. But flowers remain an essential part of the diet of all Mexicans, rich and poor. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey at the Jamaica Flower Market in Mexico City.
You can see the flowers in the food. There's a slideshow on our website, worldvisionreport.org. That's a song by Emmanuel Jal, one of the Lost Boys of Sudan. He's singing about Emma McCune, the woman who adopted him, and as he tells it, saved his life.
You would have seen my face on the telly, fat hungry belly, flies in my eyes, had to be for my size. That's another little starving child, running around in Africa, born to be wise. Praise God, praise the Almighty for sending an angel to rescue me. I got a reason for being on this earth, cause no more than many words, life is worth enough. Now that I get a chance to stand my ground, I'm gonna run over mountains, leaps and bounds. I ain't an angel, hope I'll be one soon, and if I am, I wanna be like Emma McCune.
Emma died in a car accident not too long after adopting him, but she set Emmanuel on a course that changed his life dramatically.
We remember the time when I was small, when I couldn't read or write at all. Now I'm old, grown up, I got my education. The sky is the limit and I can't be stopped by no one. Oh, I pray for this day to come, and I pray that the world find wisdom to give the poor in need some assistance instead of putting up resistance.
I spoke with our world music guide, Ishma Fundequa, about Emmanuel Jal and his life story. Hi, Ish. Thanks for joining us again.
Hello, Peggy. As always, it's a pleasure to be on the show.
And today we're talking about an artist named Emmanuel Jal. And he's had a very tragic childhood. And he's told his story a number of times
including in this video where we're going to play a clip he's talking about his life.
When I was 8, I became a child soldier. I didn't know what was the war for, but one thing I knew was an image that I saw that stuck in my head. And when I went to the training camp, I said, I want to kill as many Muslims and as many Arabs as possible. The training wasn't easy, but that was the driving force because I wanted to revenge for my family.
Ish, that's pretty intense. How did Emmanuel become a child soldier?
Well, I think we need to go back to when he was born in southern Sudan. And he was only a little boy when the civil war between the Muslim North and Christian South broke out. And his father joined the Sudan People's Liberation Army, which was the army fighting against the government. And when he was 7, government soldiers killed his mother. Emmanuel then traveled to Ethiopia, believing he would get an education there, but instead he was trained as a fighter.
We're going to play here the song War Child, in which he talks about this.
I lost my father and mother in this battle. My brothers too perish in this struggle. All my life I've been hiding in the jungle. The pain I'm carrying is too much to handle. Who's there, please, to light up my candle? Is there anyone to hear my cry? Here I am, pale and dry. Born a leader's one, I wonder why. Now I thought I could have won a die.
If you listen to the lyrics, he tells it all. He explains everything. He tells his whole story there.
And how long did he fight for, and how did he end up escaping?
He fought for 5 years, and then he got tired of it all and ran away. And after 3 months walking in the bush, he and other boys reached a town called Wat in southern Sudan. And that's where he met a British aid worker called Emma McCune. And then Emmanuel was just 11 years old. And then McCune adopted him and took him with her to Kenya, where she sent him to school. But sadly, Emma died a few months later.
Oh, how sad.
She died a few months later, but friends of hers took over the education of Emmanuel. So they made sure that he got an education.
How did this boy, who was orphaned and was a child soldier and had such a rough childhood, how did he get interested in music and actually start a career?
In Kenya, Emmanuel started singing to ease the pain of what he'd been through. Then some people encouraged him to take it seriously, and he ended up recording a number of songs that became hits in Kenya. That's how he started off.
What made him so popular in Kenya? What was it about his music?
Well, the fact that he was really addressing issues, and I think listening to him, you can tell he's a good musician. That's what everybody bought into. And he had a fascinating story to tell, this story of a boy who spent so many years fighting and survived that and was on the way to making himself something. I think that's a very fascinating story.
Do most of his songs tell stories like this?
Oh, yeah. Most of his music is really inspirational. I've not heard an Emmanuel Jal song that hasn't got a message behind it. There's always something. He's always saying something. Something positive, that is.
Yeah, and one of his latest songs is called Why, which might illustrate where his career is now. Let's listen to that.
I believe we can stay together, work together, make this land a better place, time for peace, face the challenges daily. Like a family, we could happily share all we have, faithfully. And peacefully, our land will be like a paradise. Please, open your eyes and your ears. We have many needs, can't you see? Mama crying, children dying, papa weeping. Worst things happening, like raping and kidnapping of the loved ones. We have failed to manage this world for ages. Many have been locked in cages. At this stage, the world is not safe. Human being turned into slave. Indeed, it's because of greed. Many have been made hopeless and homeless. Why do you always curse? It's time to bless. Don't protest, I suggest.
Again, it's a very self-explanatory song. Why can't we live together? This is about reconciliation and the coming together of different races, different ethnic groups. And I think that's the message he's trying to put across there.
Emmanuel Jal sounds like quite an activist, and he uses his music to get those messages across.
Well, Emmanuel supports all kinds of causes, really. On arrival in Kenya, he started raising money for street kids and refugees, and I think that he was a very young person then.
And I hear he's been fasting and only eating dinner for an entire year. Can you tell us a little about why he's doing that?
He decided to do that to save money from the other two meals to build a school, the Emma Academy, in memory of Emma McCune. He wants to raise some $300,000 for the school so other children can also get a break through education like he did. And he had been fasting for a year last December. To mark the anniversary, he released the song We Fall, which is available as a free download on the internet.
The sun won't shine forever. I'd rather have fun now or never.
We fall and get up.
Yeah.
We fall and get up.
That's right.
We fall and get up. A sham way, a sham way. We fall and get up. We fall.
Ish, thanks so much again for joining us.
Thanks, Peggy. As always, it's been fun being on the show and talking about the life and music of Emmanuel Jao, who I think is a very, very extraordinary human being.
Sometimes we fall, sometimes we cry, sometimes we lie just to get a piece of pie. I got many reasons not to give a love a try. Mama left me without saying goodbye.
Ishmafun Dekwa is our world music tour guide. He spoke to us from his home in Harare, Zimbabwe. Emmanuel Jal's autobiography is called War Child, and it's just been released in paperback.
Come by here, please come by here. Touch my hair, cause I'm losing my hair. 7 years old and man, heart's gone cold. Brother slaying brother as a prophet foretold. Rivers turning red, kids burying the dead. Rivers turning red, kids burying the dead.
In Sicily's capital, Palermo, fast food is available on nearly every corner, but you won't find a golden arch in sight. Sicilians are eating their own versions of fast food: chickpea fritters, fried rice balls, even spleen sandwiches. The food's affordable, and that's important because one in three Sicilians lives below the poverty line. Reporter Nancy Greenlee's hit the streets of Palermo to find the perfect spleen sandwich.
Drivers tear around Palermo's port, passing boats with white masts poking into the sky. The deep blue sea may offer a bountiful feast, but the drivers screech to a halt at Pane Camiausa. That's the name of the tiny joint and also the type of sandwich this family-run business has sold for nearly seven decades. Gaetano Favata stands behind the counter, stirring a silver vat filled with the organ meat.
Are you going to eat one?
If you like Palermo, you have to eat a spleen sandwich.
Well, this certainly isn't spaghetti or pizza, yet Sicilians are believed to have eaten this organ sandwich since the Middle Ages. Favata has worked here since he was 15 and knows his beloved sandwich has been around much longer than his 52 years.
For centuries, centuries, since this is a dish that originated with the Jews, truly with the Jews.
Or so many say, but it's not well documented. In Palermo, many Jews worked as butchers. Some think they invented the inexpensive sandwich.
This is how spleen sandwiches started, and as the years have passed, they've evolved into these exquisite snacks. But way back when, people ate the sandwich to stave off hunger. The rich were not eating these sandwiches.
The wealthy got the best cuts of meat, and most other Sicilians made do with the rest. Spleen sandwiches are still considered pretty cheap, but these days everyone eats them. To make one, the cow's spleen is cleaned, boiled, and cooled. The organ ends up looking like a lean steak. This is where Favata's work begins.
Cut little slices of the spleen, three slices. You put them in the pan. You cook them slowly over a low flame. See the lard in the vat? We let the slices heat up for just a few minutes.
Favata grabs a crusty round roll that's soft inside to better absorb the juices. With the other hand, he dips a flat ladle into the vat and pulls up a pile of fried spleen that he delicately places on the open roll. You'd think he was doling out caviar instead of a Sicilian sloppy joe.
He
put a little salt on it, a squirt of lemon. We put paper around it, add a napkin, and give it to the customer, and you can eat it. Eat it. I'm telling you in the Palermo dialect to mangia. Eat it.
I obey, chewing the tender meat that shames those two all-beef patties.
Mmm.
It's very, very good.
The meat is a little bit salty.
Obviously fresh and well-chosen meat.
Buonissimo. Complimenti. Complimenti.
Some top the sandwich with ricotta, or the local caciocavallo cheese. Favata is convinced spleen sandwiches are healthy. He points to an article framed on the restaurant's tiled wall that backs him up. Granted, cooking a spleen in lard boosts the cholesterol level, but at $2.30, at least the price won't give you a heart attack. Another customer double parks and dashes in to pick up a few sandwiches.
You see? And he's off. It's fast food that's very fast. You order it, eat it, hop in the car, and take off. You're in and out, in and out. That's why it's wonderful. Truly fantastic.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Palermo.
You can see how the spleen sandwiches are made. There's a slideshow on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And this is where we end our show this week. Remember, we're on Facebook and Twitter. You can find details on our website. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.